Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Mordecai Breenberg.
Operation Noble Eagle is one name bandied about for what some insiders say is the U.S. plan for a 10-year war. Another name bandied about coming directly from Christian fundamentalism is Operation Infinite Justice. Regardless of the name, the first battleground appears to be Afghanistan and Pakistan. To examine this battleground, on the line from London, England, is longtime political analyst, novelist, and playwright Tariq Ali. His latest novel, The Stone Woman, will be out next month in paper, and it's the third in his Islam Quintet. Good evening, Tariq, and evening for you. Welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio. I know you were just at a demonstration and have been involved in activities against the war drums. Could you just give us some sense of what's happening in England?
Well, last night we had the first anti-war public meeting in London. And we were expecting 1,500 people, and instead 3,000 turned up. And so we had to have two overflow meetings, so I was speaking at three meetings in one night. And the general mood, Mordecai, is amongst thinking people is that this is a war they have to oppose. There were last night at the meeting, there were lots of people who've never been to these things before. There were people who supported the war in Kosovo but are now extremely nervous about this one. And also, interestingly enough, there were lots of young people, lots of kids from schools who feel very worried because they've got Muslim schoolmates who they feel concerned about, and they just wanted to know what was going on. So it's a very good atmosphere on that front.
Thanks for that. And we had contacted you to learn more about the Pakistan, U.S. and Afghan sort of triangle. In the 1980s, the CIA sank billions of dollars in weapons, energy into Afghanistan as part of a strategy mapped out by Brzezinski of bleeding the Soviet Union into collapse. And Pakistan was a kind of important U.S. agent in that strategy. I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of an overview of that Pakistan-Afghanistan relation in the period of Soviet occupation of Afghanistan.
Well, even before the Soviet occupation, I mean, essentially what happened is that in 1976, the monarchy in Afghanistan was overthrown. One of the king's cousins, a person called Daoud, toppled the monarchy and declared Afghanistan a republic. And then he was very dependent on soldiers in the army and air force officers who were supporters of the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which was like a communist party, and they finally dumped him and took direct power themselves. Unfortunately, most of these people had no idea what to do with the country, so instead of at least having some referendum on the future, they ruled by fiat and bureaucratically. Lots of reforms were pushed through on education, large numbers of women were educated, lots of women were brought into helping run the state apparatus, the teach, be doctors, etc. And the United States at that point decided to destabilize this government, hoping it would draw the Soviet Union into a bear trap. And they armed the tribes using the Pakistani military intelligence services, began to destabilize Afghanistan, and finally they dragged the Soviet Union in. When the Soviet Union intervened in Afghanistan, the American felt that this was where they wanted them, and they poured billions into creating a hardline religious opposition. And as part of this, at one stage, Pakistani inter-services intelligence felt that it would be good for morale if a prince from the Saudi royal family could come to lead the struggle. So a request was sent to Saudi Arabia, but no volunteers were forthcoming from the royal family. Instead, they recommended someone from a leading Saudi family, Osama bin Laden, who came, was backed by the Americans, trained, and actually personally very heroic. And he came and fought in Afghanistan and then stayed on.
After the defeat of the Soviets and their withdrawal, what was the conditions then within Afghanistan and its impact on Pakistan?
Well, there was a coalition of forces which helped defeat the Soviet Union, and after the Soviet Union withdrew, the obvious thing for any sane, rational power to do would have been to develop a coalition government, build civil society, give people a break. That, in fact, didn't happen. And the Saudis and the Pakistanis who had built these religious boarding schools to train fanatics in Pakistan called madrasas, kids of Afghan refugees and Pakistani, poor Pakistani peasants, sort of deracinated, bleak cosmopolitanism, who'd been educated in these schools. There were 250,000 of them. All these schools were backed by the United States. They were hurled into battle. And because they were students, they were called the Taliban, which means students. And backed, helped by the Pakistani army, they took Afghanistan. And once they captured it, they wiped out all the opposition. Large numbers of educated women left the country. Laws they imposed were hardline laws, you know, sort of inspired by the Wahhabi faith in Saudi Arabia. Women weren't allowed to be sometimes not even seen in public unless they were veiled from head to foot. Television was banned, and it became an ultra, ultra-Orthodox religious regime denounced by the Muslim Orthodox Sunni faith in Al-Azhar in Egypt and by the Shiites in Iran and Qom as being sort of alien to the teachings of the Prophet. But the United States saw nothing wrong with this, and they hoped to use lots of American think tanks, hoped to use the Taliban to destabilize Central Asia. That's what's been going on. And till last year, $42 million was paid over to the Taliban to help in the struggle against drugs. The American oil giant Unoco is putting a pipeline through Afghanistan. So basically, they turned a blind eye to what the Taliban was up to till September the 11th. Now suddenly everything's changed.
And why that U-turn, and what are its consequences for both Pakistan and...
Well, the consequences of... I mean, the reason for the U-turn is obvious, that they think Osama bin Laden ordered this action. So far, there's no proof. We haven't seen it. He's denied it in an interview and said it was a glorious deed, but I didn't order it. Well, who knows? We certainly haven't seen any proof. I mean, the reality is, Mordecai, that the bulk of the people who carried out this attack were not illiterate, bearded fanatics from the mountain villages of Afghanistan. They were well-educated, highly skilled, middle-class professionals from Saudi Arabia and Egypt, where Osama bin Laden's cadres really work and exist. So they can't touch Saudi Arabia, the United States. They don't even like thinking about it because it's such a vital part of their security in that region, that the only people they can punish are this, you know, sort of deluded regime in Afghanistan, which is the poorest country in the world. Now, Osama bin Laden is certainly there, but, you know, it's the disproportionality of it which is shocking. This was a terrorist act carried out by groups of individuals. Now, you don't punish a whole country for that. If you have the proof against bin Laden, then show it and extradite him, like with the Lockerbie bombers. But they haven't done that. They've decided to go, you know, it's sort of bloodlust and cowboy discourse rules the day, I'm afraid.
The head of the Pakistani military junta, Musharraf, has decided to go with the Americans. What kind of consequences does that raise for Pakistan itself? What kind of contradictions from these last 20 years are ignited by that decision?
Well, I mean, the fact is that for the last 20 years, the jihadis, the sort of holy warriors, have been working totally hand in glove with the Pakistani army, with the full knowledge and complicity of the United States. This is just a fact. Many American think tanks working on this part of the world will tell you that. It's not a big secret now. They want the Pakistani army to collaborate in toppling a regime which the Pakistani army created. The only triumph and success of Pakistan since 1947 has been the victory in Kabul. So they want it unraveled. Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, within the Pakistan army itself, there is a hardline religious extremist faction. Its size is a matter of dispute, so we don't know what will happen. What the United States did was to threaten the Pakistani generals, either you collaborate or you're the enemy and we'll deal with you as well. Well, the generals were offered so much money that they've decided to collaborate. Pakistan's whole external debt of $38 billion will be written off. Just shows that these things can be done. More money will be poured in. Sanctions will be lifted if they play ball. So the generals are hoping that if they play ball, the country will recover. But in the meantime, the effects of this in society as a whole are unpredictable.
Pakistan was promised things earlier, and it seems not carried through by the U.S. What reason would there be for them to have considerable confidence in the current promises, whether it be the writing off the debt or anything else?
They will make sure that some of this will happen while these actions are going on. I think they have got some of these promises in writing, and the international financial institutions have confirmed this. Certainly the Pakistani finance minister, Shaukat Mahmood, is very excited at the moment. But the elite is certainly happy that they are back in the Western fold again after years of being outcasts. But the society in which they've created over the last 20 years is explosive. Lots of these jihadi groups are armed. They have their own training camps. They've been waging terrorist war against each other. They've been bombing the cities long before September the 11th, so I can't see them stopping now. And then the other thing which we've got to try and think about is, what is the United States going to do in Afghanistan? I mean, they'll bomb from on high and try and destroy everything first, but there's not all that much left to destroy because it's a destroyed country after three civil wars anyway. So they'll take American paratroopers will go in, and if they can find Osama bin Laden, capture him. But what if the Taliban fight back? I mean, there's too many imponderables in this at the moment, Mordecai, to be able to map out a scenario.
The former Pakistani Foreign Secretary, Niaz Naik, was interviewed on BBC this week, and he spoke that he'd met Americans in mid-July in Berlin in a conference on Afghanistan, and was told by them that they planned to topple the Taliban before the middle of October. I'm wondering whether that kind of information sounds credible to you, and that the terror attack provides just an opportunity to proceed more effectively with a pre-existing U.S. strategy?
I don't know, because the Afghans didn't, you know, I mean, the terror attack would not be planned by the Taliban leadership. They're very provincial-minded people. What they would do is kill their rivals locally, which is what they did. Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was backed by the West recently, and had been fighting against the Taliban, two Algerian hardline fundamentalists pretending to be journalists went to see him and blew themselves up and him. He died after a short time. He was sort of quite a, you know, relatively secular-minded leader. So I think that information would have got them to wipe out their rivals internally, hoping that if they did that, there'd be no one to replace them. But the attack on the United States, I think, probably had been planned for a much, much longer time, because, you know, horrific though it was, the execution was pretty amazing.
Bush's speech on Thursday night, he seemed very much to raise the demands on the Taliban well beyond his initial order for the handing over of Osama bin Laden.
I think that the United States feel they have to topple the regime to show that they've scored a victory, and they might succeed in doing so. But what they don't realize is intervening in this fashion in the world of Islam creates more problems than it solves. I mean, the real hostility and anger is in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, things which they don't like to discuss. And fundamentally, the two real problems in the Middle East are Palestine and the continuing sanctions and the non-stop 10-year bombing campaign against Iraq. This angers large numbers of people who feel that that double standards operate. Israel can do what it wants, Iraq can be punished, but meanwhile the United States only gets worked up if its own citizens' lives are put at risk.
Well, let me return to where I began, which was these talk of a 10-year war. We saw the U.S. construct a coalition in 1990 to destroy Iraq, and then they let that coalition implode because they weren't willing to address the essential injustices on the Palestinians. And then there was a coalition to smash Serbia, which left huge dislocations and ongoing civil war in Macedonia. It's murky, but I'm still wondering what you could penetrate in terms of America's new long-term, whether 10-year or whatever, war that it's...
The American ruling elite at the moment is split itself. Colin Powell doesn't talk of a war, he talks of a campaign. The others talk much more of war. But basically, this notion of declaring war against terrorism, I mean, it's a completely nebulous business. It's sort of grotesquely simplified. You can't declare war against individual terrorism because you don't know where the individuals are. I mean, Detroit is the largest Arab city outside the Arab world. I mean, in 10 years' time, if they go bombing the Arabs again, what if people there get worked up? Will they bomb Detroit? Are they ever going to bomb Saudi Arabia, their closest ally in the Middle East? Obviously not. But this is where the whole business hasn't been fully thought out. My own feeling is that they need a short, sharp campaign and a victory. And having toppled the Taliban, if they succeed in doing that, they will then come back and the rest of the thing will fizzle away, just like the campaign against drugs and the campaign against that and the campaign against other things.
Well, thank you very much. It's been illuminating hearing you. Thanks, Tariq.
Okay, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Tariq Ali in London, England. He's a playwright and author. His latest novel, The Stone Woman, is going to be in paperback in October, and it's the third volume in a series called Islam Quintet.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.